Before we get started on my lesson, I just wanted to show you something that came up yesterday that, you know, I've been showing you this, and it just keeps happening over and over, and I just want to show you how important this continues to be. This was a statement that came out yesterday from Osama bin Laden, and again, he stated, America will never dream of security unless we have it in reality in Palestine. He added, God willing, our raids on you will continue as long as your support to the Israelis will continue. Okay, from day one, this is what he has said has been the real sticking point with him and Al-Qaeda. Politically speaking, and if you read the newspapers and stuff, this really doesn't come up. It's more of a political situation. If we just get out of Saudi Arabia, if we just get out of Iraq, if we just do this, everything's going to clear up. It's not going to clear up because his statements have not changed. I'll show you. This is from May of 08 to Western nations. This speech is to understand the core reason of the war between our civilization and your civilians. I mean the Palestinian cause. The Palestinian cause is a major issue for my Islamic nation. It was an important element in fueling me from the beginning and the 19 others, that's the World Trade Center, with a great motive to fight for those subjected to injustice and the oppressed. So, Palestinian cause. This is 1202. The creation and continuation of Israel is one of the greatest crimes, and you, the Americans, are the leaders of its criminals. There is no need to explain or prove the degree of American support for Israel. The creation of Israel is a crime which must be erased. He hasn't changed. Not at all. Shortly after 9/11, we have demonstrated and stated many times for more than 2.5 decades that the cause of our disagreement with you is your support to your Israeli allies who occupy our land of Palestine. So, one more time. This is the foundational reason why he and his group and many Islamic teachers are against the United States is our support of Israel. Period. They see that as Islamic country, and as long as there are Jewish people there and support for those Jewish people, they will continue their effort. They see this as a religious conflict. We don't like to mention that, and our politicians don't like to specify that, but if they believe it, we might want to look at it from that direction. Okay? So, again, it keeps coming up over and over, and it's the exact same thing. It is not a political thing in nature. There's something a lot deeper to it than that. So just popped up on the screen again yesterday. I just wanted to let you know that that's still the reasons behind it. Today I want to start a new series, but what I want to do is to look at the case, the evidence that we have for this book. The evidence that we have for God's holy word, what it says it is, what we believe it to be. Do we have evidence to support that? Do we look at this as what it claims to be as God's holy word? Why or why not? What I want to do is to get to the point that you have the confidence to stand firm in God's word and to know that this book is what it claims to be. Because as we're challenged in our faith, this is usually the first thing that comes up as to its validity. Because if this falls, then everything else that we have to stand on will be considered questionable. Okay? So, if we can show that we have evidence for our faith in God's holy word, then it makes our case a lot easier. This book is the most sold book in the world of all time. It is the most owned book in the world of all time. It is the most given book of all time. It may not be the most read book of all time, but at least more people own it and have given it. Okay? It is also the most criticized book of all time. It is the most defended book in history. Most criticized, most defended. It has been the book that has been destroyed more times than any other book and restored more times than any other book. There have been attempts throughout the ages to destroy all copies of the Bible, yet it has endured and been restored and kept going. Why is that? Why would that be? It is the most studied book. It is the most quoted book. It is the most translated book in history, over 2,000 languages. Neither history nor archaeology has ever proven this book wrong. Okay? It is the most compared book historically and archaeologically than any other book in history. It has never been proven wrong. One quote is, "It may be stated categorically that no archaeological discovery has ever controverted a biblical reference." Yet, the prevalent attitude is, this book is wrong until proven right. Over and over and over, it is still held up as questionable. No other ancient writing is looked at from this perspective. All other ancient writings are looked at as correct until proven wrong. The Bible has been continuously looked at as wrong until proven right. And yet thousands and thousands of historical and archaeological discoveries have proven it right, yet it's still in question. Why is that? Why would that be? So what I want to do to start out with this, turn to John 5. I want to show you a few things just to give you a glimpse of some things. John 5. Just to kind of give you a glimpse of some things that help me to see what it is that we have for evidence. John 5, 1. "Sometime later, Jesus went up to Jerusalem for a feast of the Jews. Now there is in Jerusalem, near the Sheep Gate, a pool, which in Aramaic is called Bethesda, and which is surrounded by five covered colonnades." For centuries, this pool of Bethesda, nobody knew where it was. They didn't know it existed. Yet John, and John's gospel is full of these very intricate descriptions of different things. He brings exact numbers, he gives exact locations, he gives exact descriptions of things all the way through the book of John. His is really almost different, quite different from the other gospels. And that's one reason. And he says, this pool is located inside the Sheep Gate. The Sheep Gate, everybody knows where the Sheep Gate is in Jerusalem. It's in the northeast quadrant, still there. And yet for centuries, nobody knew where the pool of Bethesda was. And so the assumption was, well, that's one area that the Bible is wrong. Until the late 1800s, finally, archaeologists digging 40 feet below the current grade in Jerusalem finally discovered this feature, and they knew that this was the Pool of Bethesda. So that went on for 18 centuries after the book of John was written without the knowledge, and yet people said the Bible is wrong. That was their initial response, okay? Now that they found it, they know exactly, well, yep, that fits. That works, okay? Let's look at a couple other things. Turn over to Luke 3:1. All the way through the Bible, there are hundreds of names of kings, rulers, governors, prefects, all of these government leaders and all of these people. There's names, there's dates, times, periods. All of these things have been put together. And yet, over and over, whenever there's no historical evidence for these people, the assumption is, well, the Bible must be wrong in this area. And yet, years will go by and finally there'll be evidence and they'll go, oh, there it is. Well, here's case in point. For ages, nobody could find any evidence of this man named Pontius Pilate. So Luke 3:1 says, "In the 15th year of the reign of Tiberius Caesar, when Pontius Pilate was governor of Judea, Herod, tetrarch of Galilee, his brother Philip," and he goes on with all these descriptions of who was in power. Luke was saying, here's who is in power at this time. But this name Pontius Pilate never popped up. Never popped up. So the assumption was, the Bible is wrong. There really was never a man named Pontius Pilate. Well, if there wasn't a man named Pontius Pilate, then that sort of throws a lot of other things into question. Since Jesus was brought before Pontius Pilate and his whole trial and crucifixion, everything sort of hinges on that. Because if Pontius Pilate didn't exist, then all of that event is questionable also. Until the 1960s, just 40 years ago, 50 years ago, all of a sudden in Caesarea was a Roman town, city that Herod built on the shore of the Mediterranean Sea in central Israel. He built this theater, he built all these buildings, he built a port out into the Mediterranean. And it is an enormous facility, place. It's just beautiful. Even today, all the ruins are beautiful. And it was here at the theater that they found this giant stone. And on this stone was this inscription: Temple for Tiberius by Pontius Pilate, prefect of Judea. Well, I'll be. So in the 1960s, finally, people said, yeah, there really was a Pontius Pilate. So that's in our lifetime that these things have popped up, that this thing has popped up. There really was a Pontius Pilate. All right? So that happened. Just recently, and I could go on, there's dozens and dozens. I try to collect all these things that are found and, you know, keep track of them, because the discoveries have just skyrocketed in the last few years. It's amazing to see. But I want to show you just a few things that have popped up just in the last few weeks, okay? This next one, if you'll turn over to Exodus 30, show you where it started. Exodus 30. On the south edge of the old city of Jerusalem today, there's an archaeological dig that has produced more artifacts just here in the last few years than anything in a long time. What it is the little spot of land that King David settled whenever he took Jerusalem. And it's known as the City of David, not to be confused with Bethlehem, the City of David, his origin. But the City of David was the land that he occupied in Jerusalem in 1000 B.C. whenever he took Jerusalem. The archaeologists have been digging in here the last decade or so and have just found artifact after artifact, palaces, walls, cisterns, canals, all sorts of things that date from 1000 B.C. Okay? So a lot of things have been popping up. So just a few weeks ago, they found this silver coin. And it starts here in Exodus 30, 13. It says, each one who crosses over to those already counted is to give a half shekel, according to the sanctuary shekel, which weighs 20 gerahs. This half shekel is an offering to the Lord. This was known as the temple tax. Okay? God instituted this for the Israelites. He says, this is for the sanctuary, this half shekel. So for several centuries, for the Jews, they gave what was known as the temple tax. This coin specifically is solid silver. It's a half shekel. And it was minted in the 60s A.D., a few years before the Romans destroyed the temple. Okay? So it's a relatively new thing. But what's important about it is they had never found evidence of a temple tax before. Now they have it. Now then, what does Jesus think about this? Matthew 21. Matthew 21:12. Jesus entered the temple area and drove out all who were buying and selling there. He overturned the tables of the money changers and the benches of those selling doves. It is written, he said to them, my house will be called a house of prayer, but you are making it a den of robbers. The money changers. That's exactly what was going on here, was that the normal Jewish money was not good enough for the temple treasury. So they had to exchange their common currency for the temple coins. That's exactly what this coin is. And I, like I say, it was minted in the 60s, so it was about 30 years after Jesus' time. But here's evidence of this temple tax that stretched from Exodus, 1400 B.C., all the way up to the 60s A.D., and this is exactly what they found. That's what Jesus was talking about was happening in the temple. So here it is, right there. All right? Then, just a few weeks ago, this seal was found. And like I say, a seal, whenever they would make scrolls and put wax on them and seal it to be delivered, that seal would have something on it to gain its validity as to who it's from. Well, if you'll turn back to Nehemiah, so Samuel, Kings, Chronicles, Ezra and Nehemiah, Nehemiah 7. So this is dating this from the time of the first temple and just before the building of the second temple. Okay? This was as the Jews were coming out of captivity in Babylon and Zerubbabel was building the second temple. Nehemiah was released from Babylon to go and rebuild the walls of Jerusalem. So Nehemiah is an account of the rebuilding of the walls of Jerusalem. And in chapter 7, verse 46, it says, here's a list of the temple servants. Here's all the people who are going to be assigned to the temple. And one of those names in verse 55 is Temah, T-E-M-A-H, or in Hebrew, it is T-E-M-A-C-H, Temach. Temach is the name that appears on this seal. So, now they're saying, we have a seal from the first temple era with a name of the in the Bible of a temple servant that would have been serving at the temple and probably had their own seal to carry out official documents. So, pretty amazing to be able to tie history together all the way from the first temple times until today. Like I say, they just found this like 3 weeks ago or so. So pretty fascinating things. Now then, last month in December, another find that came up, and if you'll turn over to Daniel 11, so from Nehemiah, keep going right, Jeremiah, Lamentations, Ezekiel, Daniel. Just in December, for 3 or 4 years, archaeologists had these two small pieces of this tablet that's down at the bottom part of this picture, these two smaller chunks. And with those side by side, of course, there's a lot missing. But what this is a stone tablet that's etched, chiseled, has words on it. It's called a stela, okay? So if you're in Israel and want to find one, you go out in the field and go, Stella! 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 So what they had were the two small chunks. Oh, no, that was bad. Two small chunks at the bottom, and they couldn't make out what it all said. In December, just a month ago, another museum curator in Israel was looking at these two chunks, and he says, you know, I think we have that other piece at our museum. So out of nowhere, he brings the other chunk, and guess what? It's all a whole tablet, and it all fits. Okay, so what's important about this in Daniel 11, and I'm just going to read a piece of this, and I'll briefly show you what's happening here, just to kind of show you this. It's a lot more involved in this, and I could spend quite a while. Daniel 11, 20. Now, Daniel is prophesying in Babylon about 550 B.C., 550 years before Christ, okay? And he's having a vision. One of his visions is in chapter 11, and he talks about this king from the north and a king from the south going to battle with each other and fighting over the Holy Land, Israel, okay? And in verse 20, it says, his successor will send out a tax collector to maintain the royal splendor. In a few years, however, he will be destroyed, yet not in anger or in battle. He will be succeeded by a contemptible person who has not been given the honor of royalty. He will invade the kingdom when its people feel secure, and he will seize it through intrigue. Then an overwhelming army will be swept away before him. Both it and a prince of the covenant will be destroyed. After coming to an agreement with him, he will act deceitfully, and with only a few people he will rise to power. When the richest provinces feel secure, he will invade them and will achieve what neither his fathers nor his forefathers did. He will distribute plunder, loot, and wealth among his followers. He will plot the overthrow of fortresses, but only for a time. With a large army, he will stir up his strength and courage against the king of the south. The king of the south will wage war with a large and very powerful army, but he will not be able to stand because of the plots devised against him. Those who eat from the king's provisions will try to destroy him. His army will be swept away, and many will fall in battle. The two kings, with their hearts bent on evil, will sit at the same table and lie to each other, but to no avail, because an end will still come at the appointed time. The king of the north will return to his own country with great wealth, but his heart will be set against the holy covenant. He will take action against it and then return to his own country. At the appointed time, he will invade the south again, but this time the outcome will be different from what was before. Ships of the western coastlands will oppose him, and he will lose heart. Then he will turn back and vent his fury against the Holy Covenant. He will return and show favor to those who forsake the Holy Covenant. His armed forces will rise up to desecrate the temple fortress and will abolish the daily sacrifice. Then they will set up the abomination that causes desolation. With flattery, he will corrupt those who have violated the covenant, but the people who know their God will firmly resist him. Okay. So Daniel has this vision, 550 B.C. Beginning in about 175 B.C. is a king named Seleucus. Seleucus and another king that was to be Antiochus Epiphanes. Seleucus had charge over Israel, the Israeli territory at that time. What he did was point one of his chief ministers named Heliodorus to begin taxing these lands for the Roman government. And so that's where it says his successor will send out a tax collector to maintain the royal splendor. That had never been done because they specifically said, tax all the temples. They knew the Jewish temple was where all the money was kept. Remember all those temple tax coins? Well, they kind of add up after a while. And so they knew that's where it was. Well, the battles that came on were this, that Seleucus was killed by Heliodorus. He was assassinated. So it wasn't by anger or battle. It was an assassination. Antiochus Epiphanes took reign over the Holy Land. Antiochus, in 168 B.C., he went into the temple and desecrated it by slaughtering a pig and raising a banner to Zeus over the temple. That began what is known as the Maccabean Revolt. The Jewish Maccabees, a group of, began as a family, and they gained followers and revolted and overthrew the powers of Antiochus and took back the temple. And in 164 B.C., they took the temple, cleansed it, rededicated it, and that's what became known as Hanukkah. That was the beginning of the Hanukkah celebration that the Jews celebrate every single year about our Christmas time. Okay? Just in December a month ago, they put this tablet together. These are the exact orders from King Seleucus to Heliodorus to carry out what was happening right here. That's the beginning. That was the orders that were given that set off that entire thing. Okay? So they see this as the Hanukkah Stella because this is where it began. So they have this evidence now. That's all dated to the right time period. It has Seleucus' name on it. It has Heliodorus' name on it. Everything is right there. So this was just last month. So again, we see that the Jews have always seen Hanukkah as being, that was the vision that Daniel had. They see it being fulfilled in 164 B.C. They see that vision fulfilled. We as Christians see that as that was the first fulfillment. Most prophecy has a near-term and a long-term fulfillment. We see that as being fulfilled in Antiochus Epiphanes in 164 BC, but we also see that as a precursor to the Antichrist who is to come, who will go into the third temple, desecrate it, cause the abomination of desolation in temple sacrifice, and begin the period of the Great Tribulation. Okay? That's how it all ties together. It's all here, folks. It's fun to see. All right. So that was just last month. Pretty amazing find. All right. The last one I want to show you, and like I said, I could go on forever because there's just dozens and dozens of these. Yes, sir?
Oh, I'm sorry. You said that Daniel prophesied this when?
About 550 B.C.
Okay. Then it took place in the
164 B.C. So he was 400 years ahead of the actual occurrence. Yeah. God can do that. All right, the last thing that I want to touch on is something that they just found just a few weeks ago. And it was a small stone tablet with ink writing on it. Ink, it wasn't chiseled, it was inked. And this is a text from it, and the actual text is not all that important, but the dating of the text is. They can date this to the 10th century B.C., which is the time of King David. King David was around 1,000 years before Jesus Christ. Okay? What's important is that until just a few weeks ago, most of the scholars believed that everything in the Old Testament was written down after 600 B.C. because that was the earliest evidence for Hebrew script that they had. So the theory, and it's a prevalent theory out there in the scholarly realm, is that all of the Old Testament was written down after 600 B.C. All right, now then, if you stop and think just a second. Okay, there's two trains of thought. Okay, they could have brought all of the information by oral tradition through the centuries, all through Moses' time, the Israelites' time, King David's time, all the way up to 600 B.C., and then wrote it all down. So what's the first question you got to ask? How accurate was that? Well, you know, over and over we've shown that the oral tradition with the Hebrews was quite accurate. I mean, that's what they counted on. In fact, they were suspicious of handwritten text for a long time. But you've got to ask that. How was it transmitted and was it accurate? The second thing that comes up is that throws into question all the prophecies before 600 B.C., which is a lot. That throws into question Isaiah, Jeremiah, David, and all the Psalms, all the prophecies. Because what they were saying is that a lot of that was written down after the fact. Well, then it's not prophecy. Okay? So that throws a lot of things into question. And this kind of stuff is argued about all the time. I read stuff about it all the time. Because there are some people that say, no, most prophecy really isn't prophecy. They wrote it down after it happened. Until last month. Now they have evidence that pushes it back 400 more years that includes all of the Psalms, for sure, and Isaiah, and Jeremiah, all of those prophets. And so now they know that the Hebrew text existed as early as 1000 B.C. Of course, I think they'll find that it went back even further than that, really. They'll take it back to Moses' time, is what I'm thinking. And so, again, this just popped up. Well, again, this shows, again, that here's something else that shows that the Bible is right. Here's something else that shows the Bible is right. So, we look at what has happened just here in the last few decades. Israel became a nation in 1948. More archaeological discoveries have gone exponential because the Israeli antiquities authorities have regimented it and got disciplined into it. Everything is structured, systematic research. And then you combine that with modern technology that has come along in the last few years. And all these archaeological discoveries have just gone exponential. I mean, it's just hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of things that have been found. And each one has supported, not contradicted, the Bible. Yet even with all this evidence, the Bible is still not held as the prime source of information. Why not? And what I mean is that they don't go to the Bible first and say, okay, the Bible says this, let's go find it. Very few people do that. There are some that do that. But overall, they go look for stuff first, usually to try to prove the Bible wrong. And then when they find it, well, and then they find out it's right. That's happened over and over and over. Well, the question is, that has to come up then, is why is this not held as a prime source? And the answer is because if the Bible is true historically and archaeologically, then they've got a tougher question to answer. What is that question? Is it true spiritually? Is it true spiritually? And then that's the hard question to answer. Because most people want to prove this wrong, therefore they don't have to answer spiritually to what it says also. See, if you go to Luke 2, go back to Luke 2 and 3. Luke 2:1. In those days, Caesar Augustus issued a decree that a census should be taken of the entire Roman world. This was the first census that took place while Quirinius was governor of Syria, and everyone went to his own town to register. So Joseph also went up from the town of Nazareth in Galilee to Judea, to Bethlehem, the town of David, because he belonged to the house and the line of David. Okay, there's a lot of information in there about rulers and what was happening in the government at that time. If that's true, and it has been proven to be true, and if chapter 3 that I had read before, with the 15th year of the reign of Tiberius, Pontius Pilate, Herod, Philip, all of these names, if those are true, and they have been proven to be true, then the question is Luke 9:23 also true? Then he said to them all, if anyone would come after me, he must deny himself and take up his cross daily and follow me. For whoever wants to save his life will lose it, but whoever loses his life for me will save it. What good is it for a man to gain the whole world and yet lose or forfeit his very self? If anyone is ashamed of me and my words, the Son of Man will be ashamed of him when he comes in his glory and in the glory of the Father and of the holy angels. I tell you the truth, some who are standing here will not taste death before they see the kingdom of God. If one is true, then the question is that part true? If that part is true, you've got some tough questions to answer. All of a sudden you have accountability. So that is the crux of the matter, and I'll show you a couple of other possibilities next week. But that's what it comes down to. Is this what it says it is or not? Because if one part is true, then you've got to consider all to be true. And if that's the case, we have an accountability to a creator, God, who gave us this and told us how he wants us to live. That's where it comes down to the crux of the matter. So we'll continue. Yes? I was wrong. And what she's saying is, isn't it amazing how God works through the skeptics and changes lives? And there is evidence all over the place for people who have gone out purposefully to prove this wrong and to show the world that it is wrong and have been converted themselves because of the evidence. So, and I sincerely believe that God is allowing discoveries to be made at a faster pace in the final days to say, folks, I want you in heaven with me for eternity. Please, come on.
Please,
come with me. I believe that that's what is happening. So, we'll pick up there next week with some more details like that. What I'm going to do, you're going to get homework every week too, so get ready. So, your first thing to go research is, this is This part of the Bible we know is the Old Testament. Okay? That's the part right there. We see that as the Old Testament. Of course, the Jews, they don't have an Old Testament because they don't have a New Testament either. Alright? So, I want you to tell me, what is the Jewish name for that part of the Bible? What is that name for the Jewish Bible? And how many books are in it? Okay? We have all the same text in our Old Testament that the Jews have in their Bible, but it's arranged differently. So I want you to tell me, what is the Jewish name for that, and how many books? And that's a trick question. So we'll pick up there next week, and what I want you to do is to have that confidence in what we have in God's holy word. That's what we're going to be doing. So let's have a prayer. Dearest Lord, we thank you so much that you are our creator God and have given us your holy word to endure all things. We know that there is no historical, archaeological, technological, scientific discovery that can overthrow the word of an eternal, infinite God. We know your word is true today, yesterday, tomorrow. It is everlasting, and we thank you for that. We also thank you for Donna's mother, who has seen the light in your son, Jesus Christ, and will be in eternity in heaven with us. We thank you for that life changed. We thank you for all that you do through this class that reaches out to touch other people and to show your glory here on earth. In your son's name, amen. Thank y'all.